Our next guest, you want to introduce our next guest?
Sure. It's Denisha. Is that how it's pronounced?
Denisha Smith.
Denisha Smith.
Yeah, the first name's hard, not the second one.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. I'm just going to be reading from something here. She's the author of four novels, mm-hmm. including The Illusionist, which was a New York Times Notable Book of the Year. She's won all kinds of awards for her writing, including fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Ingram Merrill Foundation. And for 11 years was a cultural correspondent for the New York Times, specializing in literature and the arts. She's also an Emmy Award-winning filmmaker and has taught literature at Columbia University, one of my alma maters, New York University,
La-di-da.
The Bread Loaf Writers Conference, and elsewhere.
And well, oh, go ahead.
Last week, she read at the Rolof Janson Library in Hillsdale. And we're so pleased to have you here with us.
Thank you.
Hi, Denisha. I knew about the new novel. You know how I found out about the new novel? There was a full-page ad in the New York Review of Books.
Wow.
Her press, the press that published the new book, Honeymoon, which you didn't mention, is
right.
The other press, which is
that.
A relatively new, smaller press. Not, mm-hmm. you know, but it was very nice. Though. They obviously backed the book heavily. I first became aware of Denisha's work when she was working for the Times because of the literary articles. And to bring this back to me, she... in her obituary of, I think I've told you this before, in her obituary of Howard Brodkey, quoted something I wrote.
No
really?
Kidding.
Yes.
I didn't know that.
It wasn't under my name. It was anonymous, but I was like, whoa, I wrote that.
Which quote was it?
About one of his books being an endless kvetch.
Yes.
Do you remember?
That's a very, can be, that could be considered a very accurate description.
Right. Well, you must have thought so, because you put it in his obituary.
Well,
I thought, oh my God, I've never.
It certainly was accurate. There were moments of brilliance in Harold Brodkey's
oh, yeah.
work, as you know.
Right. And I guess you got to do some of the obituaries for literary characters because
yes.
of your, what I didn't know until the other day was that you had gone to film school and made films as well.
I did indeed go to film school. And I made quite a large number of films, either wrote them, produced them, directed them. But there came a time when I just really wanted to try to write novels. And
were they documentary films?
Not just documentaries. Oh. There were dramas. I was actually the second woman to have a dramatic film in the New York Film Festival
yeah.
after Susan Sontag.
Ah.
It tells you how long ago it was. But now women are doing much better.
Where did you go to film school?
I went to the NYU Graduate School of Film,
which is interesting, Ellen, was before it became part of Tisch. That's well, I don't mean to date you, but
No, sorry.
It was a while back because our mutual friend Peter Aaron also went there.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Peter Aaron, the photographer, for those listening, not the musician, music writer. Did you know there was another Peter Aaron?
No, I did not know that.
It's a common confusion.
In fact, they both live around here.
They both live around there. In fact, Peter Aaron, our friend, got an email once. He told me where an old friend from Bard said, "Oh, that was a great article you had in Chronogram on Levon Helm." He said, "Well, thank you." But it was the other Peter Aaron.
That's pretty
anyway,
good.
Let's get to this novel. It's a historical fiction based on the late life, George Eliot's latter life. Is that right? Yeah. Her last years, so to speak. This is a period where her longtime lover, Henry Lewes, George Eliot, for those who don't know, of course, was a woman, had died, and she married a much younger man. Now, during this period, was her creative career more or less over?
Well, before she married Johnny Cross at the end of her life, she had written her last published novel, Daniel Deronda, which used to be one of my favorite novels, and quite remarkable. Then after George Henry Lewes died, she published a series of essays called Impressions of Theophrastus Such. And
I wondered about that book because I have a nice collected Eliot.
Wow.
And when I saw that one there, I was like, I'd never heard of that one before.
Well, it's hard to characterize. I mean, some people call it one of the first postmodern looks at literature. I find it actually hard to read, although there are some brilliant things in it.
Well, it wouldn't be surprising considering Middlemarch is considered really one of the first novels of ideas in a way, at least in the English tradition, you know, where people actually think about ideas in a novel.
Yes, exactly. As I say, what George Eliot did was people like Dickens described characters in terms of what they said, what they did, and what they wore. Eliot was one of the early novelists to go deep inside the soul, the character, the consciousness of her characters, and that's why one of her reasons she's so important.
And presumably that's what attracted you to think about her in this novel in that, some fashion.
That was part of it. Like a lot of women writers, Eliot is my literary heroine. She came before me and she was extraordinarily brilliant. And I had read a number of biographies of Eliot, and I was always interested in this late life marriage that she had at the age of 60 to this handsome young man.
That's late life.
Well, in, you know,
in those days,
60 was 80, and she was already in poor health. Mm-hmm. And, of course, life expectancy was much shorter, but she married this very handsome, wealthy young man who'd been a financial advisor to her and her companion, George Henry Lewis. And in the accounts we have, in the biographies, that marriage takes up only a couple of pages, including the very mysterious things that occurred on their honeymoon. When they got married, they wrote back to friends. They had found love at last. Now, George Eliot was, by most standards, a very homely woman. She had terrible trouble with her teeth. I mean, that was only one of the problems. Mm-hmm. And although I think as a younger woman, she and before illness took its toll on her, she was attractive. But anyway, they wrote back to their friends in England, "Oh, we're so happy we found love again." And they got to Venice. And we know that Johnny tried to commit suicide by jumping off the balcony of the hotel into the Grand Canal. And he begged the gondoliers not to rescue him, but they did. And then we know they made their way back, the couple made their way back to England and to George Eliot's estate in Surrey. And it appeared he was getting better. They told no one, virtually no one, what had happened. They said, they actually misled people. They said Johnny had had typhus, which wasn't that uncommon in Venice at that time for tourists. They said he had been ill due to lack of exercise. Anyway, he appeared to be getting better. She would write to her friends, "Johnny is recovering nicely." He would say, "I'm feeling better." But in the biographies, nothing is known beyond what I've told you. And I was always wondering what this marriage was about, what was behind it, because, you know, only a few months after they arrived back in England, they moved into this beautiful house on Cheyne Walk that, by the way, Michael Bloomberg has just bought. Hmm. And he had supervised the redecoration. And 3 weeks later, she died. And so I was just puzzled by this whole thing. Was this a tragedy? Was this a terrible ending? What was the nature of this love? And that's what occasioned the novel.
How about a John Ruskin scenario?
Well,
you know what I'm referring to, right?
Yes, I think you're referring to John Ruskin's sort of chaste love of a young girl. And both he went nuts, and the young girl eventually did. And she, I think, died of anorexia. She had been sort of a student of his, and she was very young when he fell in love with her. He said, "I don't know how to compare these."
Well, there was always that rumor, I don't know if it was apocryphal or not, that when Ruskin's first night in the boudoir, he was freaked out by what he saw.
You know, it's possible. I would say, in contemporary terms, Ruskin was probably gay, without perhaps acting on it.
Right. Is that a possibility with
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, that's what crossed my mind, too.
Yeah.
Well, Johnny had never had a relationship with a woman.
Oh.
And after Eliot died, he devoted the rest of his life to sanctifying her image. He wrote the first biography of her. He threw out any letters that could in any way reflect on her badly. So we have a very sanitized, worshipful biography of Eliot, and he never, ever had another relationship with a woman. And many of his friends, such as Lord Acton, he was a married homosexual. His friends were homosexuals, and it's possible, I don't know to what extent he acted on it. And what's interesting, I'm not sure that he would have seen himself as gay. I don't know.
Well, it's worth remembering that homosexuality was still illegal in England up until the late 60s in 20th century.
Yes, and then it, at the same time, it had a strange place in English society mm-hmm. until Oscar Wilde at the beginning of the 20th century, which created an enormous publicity. In certain ways, I think it was probably tolerated as long as mm-hmm. you didn't talk about it. And I don't know whether people defined themselves as gay in all these activities. So I just don't know.
So in writing the novel, did you you never deviate from what is factually known? Is that correct?
Yes.
Isn't that the way to do a historical fiction? Not to deviate from fact, but to speculate where there's openness.
Thank you so much for asking that question, because it's very
important.
See, Ellen?
Sorry, just kidding.
No, it's
Ellen actually knows it's my go-to question.
It's a very interesting.
I was prepared to ask it. You
thank you. Well, I'm glad you did, because this is my fourth novel, and unlike the others, it's certainly a biographical novel. And as I had said, as you said in the introduction, I had been a long-time reporter for the New York Times, and I made a decision pretty early on, and it wasn't hard, that I would not deviate from the known truth in the book. There are a couple of instances where the chronology is compressed for the sake of simply space and structure, and there are things that are left out. But what I did was, she was a very, very much a Victorian woman, and she did not write in her diaries her passions, her inner thoughts. Very little has survived of that, not in her letters. And her diaries, by the time she married Cross, were just simply notations. For example, when Cross made his suicide attempt, she wrote, Dr. Ruschetti called. Dr. Vigna came, left Venice for Wildblad. And so I wanted to fill in that part of her that we don't really know. And what I did was, I found it certainly in some of the poetry where she was less inhibited. I found it in the reminiscences of people. I found it in her autobiographical essays. I discovered a kind of total picture of her and inferred from that picture that I felt was she, that I inferred from that what would have been going on in her mind. And there were one or two things that were incredibly interesting that survived. She was passionately in love with the philosopher Herbert Spencer. He also, by the way, never appeared to have any kind of female friend. Other than they were friends, but he rejected her because he said she wasn't pretty enough. And one letter that does survive, that somehow escaped destruction, is this very sad letter where she writes to Spencer, I don't think I can live without you. Please, at least can we be friends? Something to that effect. And it just breaks your heart. So that was important. And then in about, I think it was 1913, she had had an affair with a man who owned the Westminster Review, who was married. And he lived with his wife, his two children, and the children's governess in a house on the Strand, and the governess was his mistress. George Eliot lived there, and they found the diary this man kept, and we know when they had sex. Yeah. And so,
wow. So of the biographies, did you rely on any of the biographies much, or was it more primary sources?
As much as possible, there were the primary sources. The letters, there are quite a number of letters. Mm-hmm. The diaries, which at least gave me a chronology. There are a lot of really great biographies of Eliot. The most important is Haight.
Gordon Haight.
Yes, he really set the stage. He was extraordinary. And then the most interesting recent biography, most recent that I know of, is by Catherine Hughes, where she took a kind of feminist reading of Eliot. So I acknowledge them. I couldn't have done the book without them. No.
How did you what did you decide about language in terms of recreating the language or kind of negotiating between being too much in a 19th century diction and, you know, which may have sounded too fake? I mean, how did you decide to pursue that?
I'm again grateful to you because that was a struggle and I made a definite decision. I thought it through. I decided not to try to duplicate Eliot's own prose because, it would be impossible, and it was quite exquisite when written. And I decided to write in the way that I personally know best and like, which is, I would describe it as somewhat clean language, simple language, not too flowery. I decided to use contractions, which was kind of an important decision. That was the only concession I made to the modern ear. But I felt always very concerned about being respectful of her language. Very concerned that it not jar, that the reader just go into it and flow with it and not be stopped.
So when you were editing yourself, did you find that certain contemporary formulations kind of snuck in and you had to take them out?
Well, that was astute question, because I didn't find many anachronisms in my own work. The copy editor found one or two. I had a marvelous copy editor. They were usually phrasings.
That's what I would think.
Yes. Yes, idiomatic phrase.
I mean, you didn't have her going to the movies or anything like
that. Oh, no. Well, that was very interesting because I studied everything about her world, including 19th century railway timetables to make sure I knew how long, you know, she mm-hmm. took making certain journeys. So
I wondered about the reading of the timetables.
Yes.
That explains it.
It was wonderful. And, I liked it. Because it was fun. I also estimated how long it would take a carriage to go across London at a certain time. You know, when she goes to meet George at the docks when they are going to run away together because they're not married. And I was able through various means to figure out how long it would take for the carriage to get to the docks where she would meet him at the boat.
Did you visit any of the sites involved?
I went to Venice.
That's a good excuse for a
novel. Yes. I had actually been there before, but the hotel where they had stayed was a very famous hotel. It was where Chateaubriand lived, Verdi, Wagner, lots of cool people. Turner actually painted a watercolor from a room that in the hotel. Okay, so then it was transformed into the headquarters of the Venice Biennale. And the curator showed me around the palace and we discussed the plumbing lines and where the bathroom might have been, and we figured out where her room was. So that was fun. Then I went to Coventry around near where she had grown up. You know, she had lived in Coventry in the village that she'd grown up in was outside. And it was actually amazing because the house she essentially grew up in has been turned into sort of a bar. And the Mill on the Floss, you recall, there's something called Round Pond where they go fishing, little boy and girl. And that is just this sort of polluted-looking little pond by a highway. And in Coventry, where she lived, that became the Bangladeshi Cultural Society, and is now closed. So everything has changed, everything, except for the house that he bought. The rural character of Coventry is completely transformed. And but that's all right. Mm-hmm. I looked at photographs, lots and lots of photographs of 19th century photographs of Coventry, its environs, the areas around the house. There was a coal mine, a small coal mine, quite near her house in the fields. And I found pictures of that because she writes that she could always hear the pumping the water out of the mine at night. I mean, it's a little mine in the middle of a big field in an extremely rural area, and it's very interesting. So I did that kind of.
Let me remind our listeners, Ellen, that we're talking to Denisha Smith, who has just recently published the novel Honeymoon, about the late life marriage of George Eliot, the 19th century novelist best known for Mill on the Floss, Middlemarch, Daniel Deronda. Ellen?
I was just going to ask, how it sounds like you did a lot of research and enjoyed it at the same time, but how long did it take to write the book then, including all of that research?
That's a good question. I've tried to figure it out because, you know, I would be doing other things in between writing other projects, but I would say a total of about 3 years, probably, if you added it all up. Yeah.
One thing I've noticed in historical novels is some writers feel the need to include too much of their research.
It can happen, yeah.
You know, where they start describing everything that they've picked up along the way. That's hard to avoid, don't you think?
Yeah, a little bit, except I didn't struggle with that particular issue because I was concentrating on one woman, her inner life, her struggles, her, you know, in some ways, the suffragette movement was touched her life. She was very ambivalent about it, though she contributed money to it. But I always found myself coming back to how it had affected her, how she participated. The reform movement of 1832, when there was a great movement to give more people the vote, working men, that touched her a bit. Yeah.
But isn't there an impulse to want to stop and explain to your reader something like that? You
know what I mean? Yes, there is that, and that's an excellent question because to me that's what writing a novel is about, not doing that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Exposition doesn't belong in a novel. It might in a biography, but it doesn't. Everything in the novel has to go through the characters. And the minute you're using any exposition, you're failing, as far as I'm concerned, in a literary way.
Mm-hmm.
Ha. Huh. Interesting.
Ellen's a George Eliot fan, aren't you, Ellen? No. I only read Middlemarch for the first time about 5 years ago.
That was a good time to read it.
Yeah, it was, because I would have probably not liked it in my youth, you know, or my younger years.
You know, a lot of people are spoiled for George Eliot in middle school, where they're made to read Silas Marner.
Silas Marner.
Which couldn't be less appropriate for middle school kids, and it's actually a great novel, but it's so wrong for those kids, and so they give up and they don't read. And I find going back to that novel again that it's wonderful, you know.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking with Denisha Smith, who's the author of a new book called Honeymoon,
published by The Other Press.
The Other Press.
Yes.
What's the first press? Do we know? Anyway, we're so happy that you're able to come in.
Do you have any more events related to the book coming up in the near future?
Actually, I do. I'm going to my former employer, the New York Times, has cruises in which you go on the cruise, and I'm going to the UK, and you have to deliver a number of lectures to interested passengers. They buy this, and I'm going to be talking about George Eliot on that.
Oh, great.
And then I'm going to be at the East Hampton Authors Night Book Fair, basically. And I'm also, there is a kind of a new conference in Connecticut, not far from here, around Litchfield, Kent Presents. And it's the effort of somebody to create a version of the Aspen Institute on the East Coast. Oh. So I'll be going there in August to talk about the book. And around here, not so much, but later in the, you know, in the fall, I'll be going to various places.
Great.
Did you, what do you think of the Rebecca Mead book about George Eliot?
I think it's just excellent. And I actually know Rebecca.
Oh.
And I, when I knew she was writing the book before it was published, I was very nervous because she's so good and so smart. And I deliberately didn't read it. And then when I had finished with my book, I did read it and found it was wonderful, a completely different book. It's not a novel. It's really her memoir and
right.
how she...
It's kind of a new genre of literary criticism, actually
yes.
a very old genre, but revived in an interesting way, yeah. where people are writing more about their personal involvement with great authors. You know, I've interviewed Joe Luzzi, and that was kind of what he did with
yes.
his Dante book as well. You know, just trying to reconnect this kind of subjective feeling of what it means to read, as opposed to the, you know, the mid 20th century was so concerned with pulling apart the reader and the book, and you know, examining it as some text away from the person who's reading it. And I think we're coming around again because that stuff has exhausted itself.
Well. I think that's a very astute insight. I haven't thought of it. And Joe Luzzi's book, which I happen to know, I know him slightly. In fact, he helped me with. He's a Dante scholar, as you
yep.
know. Suffered a horrendous mm-hmm. tragedy. His wife, pregnant wife, was killed.
Yeah.
He was left to raise their newborn daughter, and
Isabella.
Just an amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But. He helped me with the Dante in my novel because Eliot and John Cross fell in love over Dante. She was helping him with his Dante.
Yeah. Did not know that. Well, thank you, Denise. Is there anything else you'd like to mention before we go?
No, I hope you enjoy the book. I think it's actually pretty easy to read. It's a kind of a romance as well as telling you something about 19th century England.
Well, I did read one chapter that was on the internet. Makes me want to read more.
I hope so.
Well, I know it's available right now in Hudson at Spotty Dog.
Uh-huh.
If you want to, readers want to. I think the copy I looked at was actually signed.
Yes.
How do you like that?
I signed a copy.
So thank you for coming in and talking about your new novel, Honeymoon, about George Eliot in her last years and her unusual marriage, which is worth speculating about.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome.
I've enjoyed it.